Near 38. We're sitting at about 44 right now in downtown Butler. I'm Tracy Morgan in the Next Tier Bank studios. Next Tier Bank, your hometown community bank. News time 12:30. Dave Malarkey's coming up next with It's Your Turn. Thanks for joining us and have a good day.
And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn, 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
Well, hello there. Good afternoon. Welcome. Nice to have you with us on the Tuesday edition of It's Your Turn here on WISR. Tuesday edition, kind of a gray day. We had rain overnight and even for a while early this morning in a few parts of our listening area. But the rain showers pretty much moved out. They will be back. Certainly here and there tonight and tomorrow, but then we're looking at some real rain on Thursday and Friday of this week. Very warm temperatures, well up into the 60s at the end of the week, but looks like very wet too. Today, it's just kind of a gloomy day. It kind of matches our mood, right, as we struggle along here in these uncharted waters. It's just something that we've not experienced before. No one has experienced anything like this before. Well, we're still trying to look on the upside. We celebrated the Feast of St. Patrick this morning on the early morning show, playing some music of Ireland for you. Those of you who are up and around early, hope you enjoyed that. Open talk to begin our program today. Phone number is 283-2525. Has anybody been to Ireland? Any listeners been to Ireland? Where did you go? Did you have a good time? Did you like it? Were you there over St. Patrick's Day? I never was, although I've been to Ireland many, many times. But we can talk about that. We can, you know, try to talk about some good stuff today so that we don't get too depressed about our current situation, huh? What do you say? 283-2525. Hi there, caller. This is Dave Malarkey. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
Just wanted to say thanks for the music.
Oh, well, I'm glad you enjoyed. I had some pretty authentic Irish music this morning, so I'm glad you liked it. Thank you. 283-2525 is our number, 283-2525. Just a little bit about, before we talk about Ireland, a little bit about what we're doing here on the program today. We're trying to do our part in light of Governor Wolf's announcement yesterday and President Trump's news conference yesterday. So we have limited our staff here at the radio station. And we have some people coming in on alternate days now. We have also, on this program, It's Your Turn, we've canceled all of our live guests that we're due into the studio for, you know, safety reasons, obviously. Those were the guidelines we were to go by. So we will have no, at least for the next 2 weeks, we will have no live guests here in the studio. We are doing phone interviews, however, and we have several of those lined up. It's been a pretty dicey process here because we had to cancel so many guests that we, you know, had lined up for the next 2 weeks. But we're putting it together, and, you know, we'll share together. And we may also, every once in a while, bring you a best of It's Your Turn interview from times past. But we're trying to do our part to follow the guidelines. So we'll have no live guests in the studio, at least. By telephone, yes, but here in the studio, no, for the next couple of weeks. WISR time is about 12:35, and so in Ireland it's 4:35. Yeah, I was just checking the weather for Dublin. Dublin Airport right now it's 59 degrees, so they're a little bit warmer than we are. Rain in the forecast, which is not unusual for for Ireland. Right now at Dublin International Airport, it's partly cloudy. They have some sun, but boy, I was looking at the radar. And rain showers, heavy rain showers are quickly over, spreading the entire country. So it'll be raining in Dublin before too much longer. And by the way, if you're wondering, 4:36, coming up on 4:37 now, 4:36 in Ireland, and you're thinking, wait a minute, I thought that Ireland was 5 hours ahead of us, just like Dublin. Ordinarily, they are. But here in the United States, we've already switched back to daylight saving time. We did that a little over a week ago, a week and a half ago. The European Union has not done that yet. So they are still on standard time. So Ireland right now, and London, only 4 hours ahead of us instead of five. Is that too confusing? No, I don't think so. Whenever they switch over to daylight saving time, come the end of the month, I don't know the exact week, but it's toward the end of March, then we'll be back to the five-hour time difference, and Paris will be 6 hours ahead of us, and Rome will be 6 hours ahead of us, and so on and so forth. But it's a little goofy right now, simply because here in the U.S., we go back to daylight saving time earlier than anybody else. So what about Ireland? As I mentioned, it's 59 degrees right now at Dublin International Airport. The airport in Dublin, by the way, is north of the city. And it's very similar to Pittsburgh International. You know, if you're driving from downtown Pittsburgh to Pittsburgh International, it'll take you, what, better part of half an hour, depending on traffic out the Parkway West. Might be a little shorter, might be a little longer. Pretty much the same thing to get from downtown Dublin to Dublin International Airport, north of the city, near a town called Swords. And it's a beautiful new airport. They just, within the past decade, built a magnificent new terminal, new international terminal, much, much bigger than the old one. And it's very nice. However, flights are limited, as they are in most of the world these days. I'm sure you've heard that many of the U.S. carriers are cutting back on their fleets, grounding some of their planes, simply because people aren't traveling, you know. It's only essential travel these days. And in some cases, countries have limited international flights a great deal. Some of them restricting them to almost none. So airports are not as busy as they ordinarily would be. And Ireland is certainly not in the celebratory mood that it ordinarily would be on this date. St. Patrick's Day, they still celebrate. But they're in very much the same situation that we are here in the United States. In fact, they closed down all of their schools last week in Ireland. All schools, daycare centers, and so on, shut down. They're not in total lockdown like Italy and Spain and France, but they are certainly restricted, much like we are here, actually. Conditions are about the same. We, just starting yesterday, closed all of our schools. And you know of the other restrictions, of course. So similar conditions in Ireland. They have cases of the virus. They've had a few deaths. Their population, of course, is nowhere near as large as ours. In the Republic of Ireland, 7 to 8 million people, rounding off. We have, what, 350 million here in the U.S., so yeah, it's quite a big difference. How big is Ireland, you know? How big? Well, I'll give you a comparison. I won't give you the square miles because that's meaningless. The entire country of Ireland is about the size of South Carolina. So that'll give you a comparison of how relatively small it is compared to the United States. How long does it take to get to Ireland? Well, it depends on where you leave from. When I go, I usually fly out of Boston, Logan Airport. I've flown out of other cities. But it's about 5.5 hours, depending on how much of a tailwind you have, to fly from Boston to Dublin, which is, you know, it's a long time to be in a plane, but it's doable. Yeah. Takes a little longer to come back, by the way, about an hour longer to fly from Dublin back to Boston, and that's simply because in almost all cases you're battling a headwind. You know, most of our winds go from west to east. And when you're battling a headwind the whole way back across the Atlantic, it takes a little bit longer. So about an hour longer to come back. The Irish national airline is Aer Lingus, which is Gaelic. Irish Gaelic, it means air fleet, Aer Lingus. And the planes are instantly recognizable because they all have a huge shamrock painted on the tail. And it's always nice when I'm at Logan International Airport in Boston, even as you're taking the shuttle bus out to the international terminal, which is way out on the end of Logan Airport. You can tell that you can see that big green tail sticking up with the shamrock on it, and you know those are the two Aer Lingus planes that are getting ready to fly across the ocean. And it's almost always the same. If you're flying from the U.S. to Ireland, whether you're leaving from Boston or New York or Chicago or Washington, D.C., you know, the flights are all overnight flights. Leaving in the early evening or a little bit later, and flying all night, and then arriving in Ireland either shortly before dawn or shortly after dawn the next morning. So if you can sleep on a plane, that's great. If you can't, well, then it's a bit of a long night. Actually, depending on the time of the year, if it's summertime, you will fly into the sunrise, which is kind of nice. It happens all of a sudden. It's dark and then all of a sudden, bang, sunrise. If you're flying at other times of the year, you'll be landing in the dark. I've been blessed to visit Ireland many, many, many times. And gosh, it would be hard, to pick the most beautiful part of Ireland. I've not seen everywhere, of course, even though I've been there many times. The west of Ireland is kind of raw and untamed. There are cities there, a couple of large ones. Galway is on the west coast, facing the Atlantic Ocean. Sligo is on the west coast, north of Galway. Another large city is Cork. It's on the southern coast, closest to France. And then Dublin, of course. The capital of Ireland is on the east coast, across the Irish Sea from Wales. And the topography differs from place to place. There are some mountains. They're not like the Rockies, but there are some mountains in the west. McGillicuddy's Reeks in County Kerry are the highest mountains. In the east, it's the Wicklow Mountains, just south of Dublin. In fact, you can see them from Dublin off in the distance. Again, they're not like the Grand Tetons, but you can see them. And they're very picturesque as you head south of Dublin into County Wicklow. It's a gorgeous countryside. Gorgeous indeed. Most of the time that I was going to summer school in Ireland, and I did that for the better part of 10 years, I was in County Wicklow. That's where the J.M. Singh Summer School was located, John Millington Singh Summer School. And, St. Patrick's Day comes, and I think back with great fondness on those many years that I spent there for a couple of weeks during the summer, studying Irish theater and Irish literature and making so many friends, not just from Ireland, but from other countries, too, who were attending the summer school, J.M. Singh Summer School, which took place in a small town of Rathdrum in the Wicklow Mountains. Rathdrum. Just so happens that J.M. Singh, who died young, had Hodgkin's disease, just as Mario Lemieux had, but back at the turn of the 19th century, and there were no treatments for Hodgkin's disease. So J.M. Singh only wrote 7 plays. And almost all of them were set in the Wicklow Mountains, very near the village of Rathdrum, which is why the summer school was held there. And what a wonderful treat that was. I was able to meet so many Irish playwrights and authors and actors over the years. The late Seamus Heaney, the great, late great Irish poet. He died just a few years ago. I was at the school, was able to meet him, talk to him. Who else? Jennifer Johnston, another Irish author. Still writing, I think, even though she's 90 years old now. Jennifer Johnston, oh gosh, how many books? A whole bunch. My favorite of hers was The Railway Station Man. How Many Miles to Babylon, another good Jennifer Johnston book. Won a bunch of awards. She is I have a couple of autographed copies of books for her. She's not the friendliest person in the world. She's not crotchety by any means, but and she was already well up in years when I met her a couple of times. But very, very talented lady. Actors and actresses that I've been blessed to meet at summer school. Fiona Shaw, incredibly talented actress. Does all of Shakespeare, does a lot of movies. You may have seen her in The Butcher Boy, among other films. And, of course, I never got to meet Saoirse Ronan, who's the latest really big Irish star, a young woman. She's, I don't know, how old is Saoirse? Like 22, 23, something like that. Already has 4 Academy Award nominations. Most recently, just earlier this year, for Little Women, she was nominated for Best Actress. Did not win, but she was nominated. Never had a chance to meet her. Maybe sometime. Huh? Maybe sometime. Well, as I mentioned, Ireland is not particularly celebrating today. There's no parade. Dublin always has a huge St. Patrick's Day parade. Some other cities in Ireland do as well. But none of that going on this year with the slowdown and the shutdown due to COVID-19. Striking Ireland just as it has here. The Prime Minister of Ireland, the Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, announced their closings and shut down late last week, so they're a little bit ahead of us. The wearing of the green. You know, even though we have limited staff here at the radio station today, with some folks off, some folks here, as we try to follow the guidelines, yeah, we've got some folks who are wearing the green here today. Saw Taylor come in, one of our front office people, with the, you see that scarf she has on, the tricolor scarf? Yeah. The green, the orange, and the white, the 3 colors of the Irish flag. And we're flying it outside our studio here today, wearing of the green, waving the tricolor. Well, happy St. Patrick's Day to you. And to you and yours, hard to be too happy under the circumstances that we find ourselves this year, but we celebrate the Feast of St. Patrick anyway. And don't forget, you know, a lot of folks especially here in this country, you seem to think of St. Patrick's Day as, you know, a day of green beer and you know, partying, that sort of thing. You can have a good time, but that's about much more than green beer. I mean, that's just silly. St. Patrick was a real person. Long, long time ago, back in the 400s. Yeah, we're talking 400 A.D., late 400s for Patrick. We don't know a tremendous amount for sure about St. Patrick. We know that he was not Irish native born, that's for sure. He was from probably what is now Wales, or perhaps England, or maybe even Scotland, somewhere on the island of what we now call Great Britain. And he was actually kidnapped by what we would term pirates, Irish pirates, and taken to Ireland as a very young man. And he was a slave there for a number of years, managed to escape, make his way back to either Wales or England. Of course, we didn't have those names back then, but to that larger island. And then he had a vision to go back to Ireland. By this time he was ordained and went back to Ireland with the mission of bringing Christianity to that pagan land. And that's what he did when he went back over. And of course, the rest is stuff of legend. Speaking of which, St. Patrick did not drive the snakes out of Ireland. If you heard that legend, not true. It is true that there are no snakes in Ireland. No, no snakes. But St. Patrick did not drive them out. No. There's a mountain in the west of Ireland called Croagh Patrick, that a lot of people climb, sometimes in their bare feet, to honor the memory of St. Patrick. And there are lots of St. Patrick's churches and cathedrals around. The biggest one would be St. Patrick Cathedral in Dublin, to honor the most famous saint of Ireland. There are two others who are prominent in Ireland, at least. Behind St. Patrick, number one. Number two would be St. Bridget. Her feast day was back in early February. And the other would be St. Columbkill. Yeah, those are the big three. But most of the world knows only number one, right? Yeah, St. Patrick. Listen, we need to take a break. We'll do that, and we'll be back with a little more of our little bit different It's Your Turn program today, and why not? Maybe we need to break out of the mold, given the circumstances that we're in here today. So a quick break, back with more after these words.
West End Tire and Service carries tires for everything from cars, trucks, SUVs, and ATVs to heavy-duty trucks, skid loaders, and even farm vehicles. And now, through March 19th, get $10 off every in-stock snow tire you purchase. Whether you're looking for a more aggressive tire for the rest of the season, or you just want to get a head start on next winter, you don't want to miss this deal. Stop by and see your friends at West End Tire and Service, West Cunningham Street in Butler, next to Battery Warehouse. Give them a call at 724-283-6973.
The Spencer D. Geibel Funeral Home and Cremation Services, located at 140 Newcastle Road. It's about halfway up Newcastle Hill, just down from the State Police Barracks. This is the Butler area's newest funeral home, Spencer D. Geibel Funeral Home, the first and only value-designed funeral home, built specifically for that purpose. A funeral home that offers styles, types, and levels of service that others are not able or willing to offer. They can transfer all prearranged funeral services and policies as well. It's an entirely new idea. It's local, and there's a hometown gentleman running the operation, Spencer D. Geibel. Spencer D. Geibel Funeral Home and Cremation Services, 140 Newcastle Road in Butler. Not affiliated with any other funeral home. It's the Tuesday, St. Patrick's Day edition of It's Your Turn here on WISR. Nice to have you with us on the program today. In just a few minutes, we're going to be chatting with a guest by telephone as we've switched all of our guests out of the studio now for the next couple of weeks at least. And who knows, maybe not too much longer than that. We certainly hope so. But we'll be chatting with Daniel Calder in just a few minutes here on the program. So if you've been wondering about the most Irish cities in America, I got a note from Elia Hoyt today. Elia Hoyt from the Apartment Guide website. And she said they've compiled a list of the most Irish cities in America. 32 million Americans claim Irish ancestry. In the most recent census reports, the Irish were originally persona non grata in the U.S. after they fled their homeland's potato famine back in the mid-1980s. That's when most Irish immigrants came here. And back in the mid-1800s, Americans were less than thrilled about the Irish invasion, which they believed threatened to bring disease, crime, and job insecurity. The Irish were not welcomed, even though they were in the midst of a famine, a severe famine in their own country. Nearly one-third of the entire population of Ireland emigrated during the famine years. Can you imagine losing one-third of the entire population of your country? Yeah. Well, as the fictional half-Irish heroine Scarlett O'Hara would say, fiddle-dee-dee to that. Fiddle-dee-dee to that. Well, back to the list by Apartment Guide, and you might be surprised. According to their research, the most Irish city in America is Pittsburgh. Yeah, Pittsburgh. Proud to be the most Irish city in America, with nearly 43,000 Irish, or over 14%. Of the total population. And that's one of the reasons why, ordinarily, Pittsburgh has the massive St. Patrick's Day parade. Not held this year, of course. No St. Patrick's Day parades anywhere. It was canceled due to our present circumstances. But there's a lot of other Irish culture that lives on here in the Pittsburgh area. So I thank Elia Hoyt for that notification from Apartment Guide, the website Apartment Guide. I wanted to mention a quick note here before we go to our guest, Daniel Calder. For those of you who, you know, the kids are at home for a couple of weeks now, maybe you're at home, even if you don't have kids, because your workplace has either closed or has a diminished workforce. I got a note from Lori Hinterleiter, who's the director of the Butler Area Public Library. And she reminds people that all of their online resources at the Butler Area Public Library, even though you can't go there physically, all of them can be accessed from their website, which is butlerlibrary.info. Butlerlibrary.info. Patrons can click on the e-resources tab, and the list of the most popular resources available online: OverDrive, ebooks and audiobooks. RB Digital, available online, e-audiobooks. Flipstar has e-magazines. FreeGal, streaming and downloadable music. And Power Library, Pennsylvania's electronic library. So, you know, if you're looking for something to read, something to pass the time, if you're homebound or trying to stay home as much as you can, there you go. Online at butlerlibrary.info. In addition, the Youth Services Librarian, Tiffany Harkle-Rode, will be hosting a virtual story times. And you can check story times on their social media pages as well. They have also extended due dates for loaned materials until April 13th. Items currently checked out, there will be no fines that accrue. So, in order for patrons to access the online resources, library card expiration dates are being extended as well. So we thank Laurie Hinterleiter, the director of the Butler Area Public Library, for some tips there if you're looking for, you know, ways to pass the time under these unusual and trying circumstances that we find ourselves in, along with many, many, many other countries in the world. In fact, it's worse in a bunch of other countries than it is here in the U.S. All right, we'll take a break. And when we come back, the Infernal Library with the Daniel Calder. That's coming up here on It's Your Turn on WISR right after these words.
Concordia Visiting Nurses has resources for patients who struggle with a serious illness. Visit cvnpalliativecare.org, an online educational website designed to help the seriously ill and their families to live as comfortably as possible while still receiving curative care. This free educational website offers practical tips and information. Choose Concordia Visiting Nurses.
Hey, here's a good way to beat the winter blahs. Get out of town for a few days. Why not take a trip with Butler Motor Tours? Butler Motor Tours, a local company. They're on South Monroe Street in Butler. They've been around for more than 75 years. And when you travel with Butler Motor Tours, you travel in comfort on one of their big motor coaches, their big cruisers. By the way, they always take trips down to Florida, too, in the winter months. So there's an idea to look at. If you want to check out their offerings, just go to their website. It's butlerbus.com. Butlerbus.com. All their upcoming trips are listed there with the dates and the itinerary and the cost and all of that. You can even book online if you so desire. And you can get gift certificates too. Butler Motor Tours. Check them out online at butlerbus.com. That's Butler Motor Tours online at butlerbus.com. We have a most fascinating book, listeners, to discuss on the next segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR. My name is Dave Malarkey. The author of that book, Daniel Calder, joins us by telephone. The title is The Infernal Library, on dictators, the books they wrote, and other catastrophes of literacy. Daniel Calder, nice to meet you. Terrific to have you with us for a few minutes here today.
Thank you for having me.
Your title is intriguing beyond belief. As soon as I saw it, I was talking with your publicist. I knew that I wanted to chat with you. So what's this all about? You've examined dictators over the past 100 years or so, and then the writings that they left?
Pretty much. So a few years ago, I discovered that Saddam Hussein had written a novel. And I thought this was... So I got a copy and I read it. And it was a romance novel. And it was fairly terrible. But it wasn't an ordinary romance novel, as you might expect. It had kind of mixed in politics with kind of like scenes of rape and other terrible things. And it was just really, really bizarre. And then this kind of made me think about all these other dictator books I'd heard of, like, you know, Chairman Mao wrote the Little Red Book and Gaddafi wrote the Green Book. And I started digging into it, and I discovered that basically over the course of the last century, and even into this century, a great number of dictators had written not just one book, but many, many books. And that there was almost a tradition of dictators, all the way from Lenin through Stalin, Hitler, Mussolini, Mao, and then, you know, some of the smaller dictators. They were all like prodigious producers of terrible prose.
And these were books of all different genres. You know, many people might be familiar with a book or two, a title or two from Adolf Hitler, but These guys wrote romance novels, fiction, even poetry sometimes.
Yeah, quite a few of them were poets. And I think that's what really interested me when I started looking into it. I thought, okay, I lived in Russia for about 10 years, and I was familiar with these shelves just lined with the works of Lenin, which are, you know, very political writings. But, you know, like I said, Saddam Hussein did this romance novel. Mussolini, he was actually a journalist for a good 20 years before he was dictator, and so he tried his hand at almost everything, from biography to memoir to novels. And then poetry, a lot of them wrote poetry. So Chairman Mao wrote poetry through his entire career. Ho Chi Minh wrote poetry. Stalin, when he was a teenager, wrote poetry that was actually, it was quite successful. It got published in prestigious journals. Huh. And, you know, and so maybe he wasn't even a bad poet. Maybe he should have, you know, considered that as a career instead.
Who knew? And the reason why nobody knows is because, from what I read in your book, Daniel, most of these works are entirely unread today.
Yeah, that's one of the other things that really interested me is, you know, these books were almost, they were sacred texts in the regimes. So when these dictators came into power, these books, some of which they'd written, you know, years earlier, would be forced on the masses, and they had to study them, and they were at the center of these personality cults. And so they would have, like, print runs in the millions, or in Chairman Mao's case, even over a billion for the Little Red Book. And people were, they were everywhere. And yet, so almost the minute, like, these regimes disappear or collapse, the books vanish. And they literally vanish, you know. Hmm. You get to, I guess the trauma of reading them is such that they just, nobody wants to do it anymore, which is understandable. But I remember when I lived in Russia, it was actually, you know, quite hard to find some of these books. It's hard to find the original books by Stalin. When I was doing research, I have quite a few friends in Poland, and they'd grown up under these kind of regimes. And I asked them, like, did they remember, you know, what books had they been forced to read? But even their memories, they'd sort of erased the experience. I mean, I guess they'd been sort of reading them, but not really reading them. You know, they knew they had to do it. And then the minute that kind of obligation was lifted, they just kind of disappeared and faded into the sands of time.
You were in Russia. Did you live in Moscow for a while?
Yeah, I did. I lived there for nearly 10 years.
Wow.
Pretty much. And it was an interesting time because I was there, arrived in the mid-90s when Boris Yeltsin was the president, and it was this kind of chaotic bandit capitalism. And then I left about end of 2005, start of 2006, when Putin was kind of strengthening his hold. So it was a transitional period.
You must be
of great historical interest.
Must be interested in the headlines these days about possible Russian interference in the U.S. election in 2016, and also very recently in the news, the possibility perhaps that Russians were involved in poisoning a former spy in Great Britain. I'm sure you've heard about that story.
Yeah, I mean, that reminds me of there's another story in, I think, 2006. There was Litvinenko was kind of poisoned, and in a very unsubtle way. So this kind of stuff is deeply alarming, and I think, you know, some of the interference is actually, it seems new because it's appearing on social media, which is a kind of semi-new technology, but I think these kind of campaigns of disinformation are very old. I think they've been going on for decades. But, I mean, the stuff in the UK is very, very alarming, you know, there's no doubt about it.
Did you ever feel threatened or alarmed or even frightened sometimes when you were living in Moscow?
I wasn't a very important person. You know, so I remember somebody gave me some advice. They said, as long as you don't, it was like if you invested in, you know, money or real estate, these big money areas, then you made yourself a target. But as long as you just, as long as you just kind of kept your head down, you were fine. And you know, I'm not a billionaire investor, so I was never going to get on the radar of any of these kind of dangerous people.
A little bit more about our guest, listeners, and then we'll talk more about his fascinating book, The Infernal Library. Daniel Calder, with whom we're chatting on the phone here, as he just said, lived in Russia, in Moscow for 10 years. He currently lives in Texas, believe it or not, but he's originally from Scotland, from Fife. That's up around St. Andrews, isn't it, Daniel?
That's correct. St. Andrews is in Fife, so I'm home of golf, no less. So
yes,
I'm from the kind of other side. I mean, Fife is very small. I'm from the town called Dunfermline, which was the ancient capital of Scotland, so kings are buried there. And Andrew Carnegie, the steel magnate, was born there. But yeah, I mean, it was historically significant at one point, but it's quite a small town now. You know,
Here in western Pennsylvania, we know that name, Andrew Carnegie, because he eventually ended up in Pittsburgh, of course. But yes, he was from Scotland.
Yeah. I think the very first Carnegie Library was in my town. Because when we grew up, we had a big monument to Carnegie in Dunfermline, and every kind of park and library or swimming pool has his name on it, so he was a kind of benefactor. So they used to take us down to respect, to pay homage to his monument when we were children. So he was a big deal.
You have a pretty scary bridge up there, if I remember correctly. Is it the Firth of Forth? Is there this gargantuan bridge that goes over the Firth of Forth up there, Daniel?
That's right. It sounds like you've been there.
I have been, yes. I've been to the shrine, the shrine of St. Andrews. I had the friends I was with take about 5,000 pictures of me in front of the clubhouse at St. Andrews, just in case one of them would come out. listeners, we're talking with Daniel Calder about his book, The Infernal Library, on dictators, the books they wrote, and other catastrophes of literature. So once you've found some of these books, and you, as you indicated a few minutes ago, it's very difficult to even find them. When you read them, I mean, it must have been boring if most of them were pretty bad, right?
It was excruciatingly boring, is the best way to put it. And I should say, you know, the book, if you look at when I published my second book, Strange Telescopes, it was 2008 when I published it in the UK, 2009 in the US, and now we're in 2018. And one of the reasons is it took a long time to read through all these books, to find them all. There was a lot of them. And then, you know, they're so awful that you have to kind of pace yourself. So you can't just sit down and read book after book after book by Lenin or Stalin. I mean, so you read it, and then you go do something else. And then, and on top of that, there was a lot of contextual reading I had to do as well, because some of the dictators I look at are quite obscure. I became very obsessed with this Mongolian dictator, Choibalsan, and he was kind of like a miniature Stalin in Mongolia, and he had his own personality cult and the kind of his own mausoleum, and kind of digging down his stuff was difficult. But I mean, that was kind of interesting. It was a kind of form of archaeology almost. I was kind of digging deeper and deeper to dig up worse and worse kind of literary atrocities, and then every now and then you'd find something that was sort of almost good, like I think Mussolini's War Diary. That really surprised me. That was quite readable. And then he did some plays. He did a play about Napoleon, and I mean, that was a hard one to track down.
Now, did you have to visit these countries, Daniel, or were you able to find some of this stuff online these days? It must have taken you a long time to do this research.
Yeah, some of them, well, because I lived in Russia for so long, and I was traveled in Central Asia, so, like, at the end of the book, I described this place, Turkmenistan, which had a really extreme dictatorship in the 1990s and 2000s, and I spent a month there, kind of experiencing and they had a book, so I experienced that kind of, like, really in close quarters, and then I've been to other places, but some of it, through the wonders of the internet, for good or for ill, you know, you can find this stuff if you dig deep enough. And I mean, in Texas, I live just outside Austin, and they have a very, very big research library at UT Austin. And I was amazed at what I could find at the University of Texas's research library. I mean, really obscure works by Chairman Mao or even, like, even more obscure Mongolian dictators. So I think, you know, if you're at some point, you know, in the 20th century, people were studying this stuff. And so sometimes you can find the books buried in the dark corners of a library. And that was actually fun. I remember getting a book by this Bulgarian dictator out of the UT library. And I think I was the first person to check it out in like 30 or 40 years. I'd just been like sitting there. And that was quite a thrill. I mean, maybe a thrill. It was just really interesting to have that sense of discovery.
Yeah.
You know, even if you're discovering something fairly awful, but it was just like, yeah, no one's even looked at this in so long because it's been forgotten.
We'll take a quick break, folks. Fortunately, we have a few more minutes that we're able to speak with our guest, author Daniel Calder. We'll pick up our conversation with him here on It's Your Turn on WISR right after these words.
This time of year, it's fish fry time at Michael's Restaurant. You can't beat the great beer battered fish with fries. You start looking forward to it the moment Lent arrives. Start your family tradition of enjoying fish fry dinners at Michael's Restaurant. That's Michael's Restaurant, with great homemade food all year long.
Try Rivers 2020. Focus on your musculoskeletal health.
I'm Dr. James Craig from Try Rivers. As a physical medicine and rehabilitation specialist, I perform fluoroscopically guided injections in our offices to treat chronic pain. This non-operative x-ray guidance approach allows me to inject the medication into various sites throughout the body with maximum accuracy. To learn more or schedule an appointment, please visit TryRiversMSK.com or call 1-866-874-7483.
From fuel to battery power, steel has been defining the future of outdoor power equipment for over 90 years. With hard-working trimmers, hedge trimmers, chainsaws, and more, steel products deliver the power professionals need to conquer their workday. And with fleet discounts for qualifying customers, steel delivers savings too. Steel is not sold at Lowe's or the Home Depot. Always at a local steel dealer. Real steel. Find yours at steeldealers.com. Lowe's and the Home Depot are trademarks of their respective companies.
We filmed 15 Pennsylvania kids who were all waiting to be adopted and asked what having a family and permanent home would mean to them.
I want a family just to accept me for who I am, to be there just to support me whenever I'm needing it.
To be matched with a family would be amazing. I wouldn't be in a system all the time.
Visit AdoptPAKids.org to watch the video, meet the kids, and learn how you can become a foster or adoptive parent.
Paid for with Pennsylvania taxpayer dollars.
Welcome back. If you're joining us a little bit late on this segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR, no problem. My name is Dave Malarkey. We're chatting pleasantly with author Daniel Calder, who visits with us on the telephone. Daniel is a journalist. He has contributed to The Guardian. You might expect that, originally from Scotland. Also contributed to Esquire magazine, the Dallas Morning News, many other publications. He lives in Texas now. And his latest book is called The Infernal Library, on dictators, the books they wrote, and other catastrophes of literacy. Let's talk about Hitler a little bit, because I didn't realize he'd written a bunch of other stuff. Probably his most famous work was Mein Kampf. Am I remembering the title of that correctly, Daniel?
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, Mein Kampf was his, you know, magnum opus, I suppose. And one of the interesting things, Mein Kampf has obviously a terrible reputation. And one of the things that struck me about that was this kind of everything you expect it to be. So my whole life, you know, I knew about this book, but I never read it. And then when I picked it up, it was as kind of venomous and frothing at the mouth as you'd expect.
Mm.
Just page after page of it was just bilious hatred. But that book almost existed by accident. And I don't think he was in prison when he wrote it, and he kind of dictated it, and so it has this very loose form. And I think if he hadn't been in prison, he might not have done it. And later he admitted, or he said to one of his associates, that he kind of regretted writing it once he was the Chancellor. And then he even said I am not a writer, were his words. So, I mean, Hitler, I mean, if he was at least aware that that was probably not a great book, you know. Yeah, that didn't prevent the regime from forcing it on people. I mean, they had a special wedding edition of Mein Kampf, which they handed out to couples. It was translated. It was rendered in Braille, so blind people could read it.
Wow, never knew that.
And I think Mein Kampf 2 is one of the few dictator books that, you know, it still has a kind of afterlife. So I mean, that you can find that online. easily. Yeah. And there's still kind of fanatics who kind of like it.
There's a picture like in your book that I've never seen before of Hitler in short pants and lederhosen. It's kind of arresting when you
yeah.
see that.
That picture is kind of is wild, and the reason I put it in there is because there's actually fashion advice in Mein Kampf, and I think it's the sort of the stupendous arrogance of a lot of these dictators is they're experts on everything, and they have an opinion on everything, and so you can be reading Mein Kampf, and there'll be some just anti-Semitic kind of atrocity going on the page, and then, but Hitler can't really maintain his train of thought very well, so suddenly he'll segue into something else, and there's like a long rant in the book about how he just really hates stovepipe trousers, and how it's outrageous, the fashions of youth today, and then he gives some advice for what they should be wearing. You know, so there's so that's why I saw that picture of him wearing his lederhosen, and I thought, I guess this is what he thought everybody should have on.
So what about the relevance of your research into these bad guys today? First of all, do you see any parallels? Here we are almost 20 years now into the 21st century. Anything that mirrors anything like you saw from these books, any of them almost a century ago?
I think maybe two things are... I mean, I think I kind of very... Well, when I read it, I found it actually quite alarming because... a lot of these books, so these guys, they were really obscure figures, Lenin or, you know, Hitler, and they were writing away in a corner. And even Mussolini was a famous editor, but he didn't have any political following. So they've been, you know, just cranking this stuff out for years and years and years. And then about 100 years ago, there was this just sort of, there was the war, but surrounding the war, there was this kind of just collapse in confidence, kind of like these systems which had been in existence for a very, very long time, these empires, suddenly they just, people didn't believe in them anymore, you know? And I felt like there was this instability and loss of belief and faith and confidence. And I think into this kind of vortex in the right conditions, that's when, like, you know, these kind of radical guys can thrive. And mm-hmm. so I don't think we're at that point yet, you know, but I do think, you know, after the Cold War, you know, there was this like feeling of optimism, it was the end of history, we were all going to be okay. But now I think there's this sort of sense of shifting and changing. You know, you have these like populist elections in Europe and things going on here, and I think nobody quite knows where we're going or where we are right now. And so not as extreme as it was a century ago, so I'm not going to be alarmist, but I felt, you know, things can change very quickly. And then more than that, I think if you look around the world right now, I mean, there's actually, when I started writing this, Gaddafi was still alive, Castro was still alive, Islam Karimov in Uzbekistan was still alive, and I almost felt I was writing kind of a footnote to the 20th century, that I was just tying up some loose ends, you know? Mm. And then there's the Arab Spring, and there was this kind of brief moment of optimism. But now we find there's a kind of new dictatorships emerging. And so, you know, Putin has really strengthened his position in Russia, and he issued a book a few years ago. You know, in Turkey we see Erdogan, who's a highly authoritarian leader. And then in China, and this is what really caught me off guard, was I think the day before this book was published, in China they had a big Communist Party Congress, and they're removing the term limits for Xi Jinping, so he can now become leader for life. And the minute I kind of learned that, I was Googling about, and I discovered that Xi Jinping has about 4 or 5 books to his name. And that these are already being praised as kind of works of genius, and they're million sellers. And I managed to get a copy of one of his books. And it begins with him praising Chairman Mao, you know, very early on. And so he's drawing a line of continuity, and Xi Jinping was like a young man during the Cultural Revolution, so he saw the Little Red Book and all that craziness. And I thought, you know, well, wow, like, you know, like decades later, that wasn't a reason not to do it, you know, or it didn't like make you go, oh, I better like stay away from that. So again, it's not as extreme, but it's is kind of coming back. So, you know, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes, as they say. And I think that's something I had in mind a lot when I was doing this book.
It's an interesting analogy. Listeners, did you know? I mean, some of the probably knew that Hitler had written Mein Kampf, but Stalin, Mussolini, writing poetry. Chairman Mao, yeah, I was familiar with him. I didn't know that Ho Chi Minh had been a writer. It's an interesting parallel that so many of these dictators actually began their careers as writers. And, of course, Stalin, Mussolini, and Hitler, as our guest Daniel Calder just mentioned, they all were nobodies at the end of World War I 100 years ago, but then they rose to power in that period between the two world wars. So you got all finished with this. What was absolutely the worst book you read after all of your research, Daniel Calder? The worst one?
Oh, that's, you know, so hard to choose. Mein Kampf is terrible. Chairman Mao's philosophy is awful. But maybe just the most incompetent and just for sheer drivel, it's probably Gaddafi. He wrote this thing called The Green Book, and it is, you can see even the title is, it was a response to Mao's Red Book, so he was making his play for leadership of the global revolution. But it has just some barking mad stuff in it, and it's totally incoherent. And you really get, you know, I don't know if you ever saw him, you know, a few years ago, Gaddafi did that speech at the UN, and he rambled on for hours without any editing. And it's like that. It's just a guy. There was no restraints, no constraints. I don't think he'd ever read a book. So he thought all of his thoughts were fascinating. And, he just goes on and on and on. And then I think it just kind of ends with him saying he doesn't like boxing very much, you know. And so it's totally arbitrary. It's like, here's how we organize society. And by the way, I don't like boxing very much. So that was probably the worst.
One point, and we have to wrap up here. Our time is getting short, but most of these guys didn't realize that what they thought were radical thoughts were really nothing new. They had appeared previously and political experiments, part of regimes that had already failed badly. So they were a little bit, they overestimated, I guess, their own self-importance or the self-importance of their writings, eh?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a recurring theme across all of these guys, is kind of monstrous arrogance and total conviction that they have the answers, you know, to history, to politics, to everything. And, you know, when you read them, it's like, actually, like banal or just false or obviously absurd. But that didn't stop them, you know, and so so they kept going. So I think that kind of, and I think that's maybe what divides them from normal authors who may also be quite egotistical, or even politicians. I think every politician needs a healthy dose of arrogance, but these guys took it to a cosmic level, and then it spread to their belief, not only in their own abilities, but in the genius of their writings. So, in their eyes, at least, everything they touched turned to gold, but in reality, it was the opposite.
Daniel Calder has written some other books, folks. He comes up with these great, intriguing titles. His latest, The Infernal Library. Two of your earlier books were titled Lost Cosmonaut and Strange Telescopes. They make me want to read them, Daniel, just by the title. Are they still in print, by the way?
I think definitely you can get them, as e-books. I mean, they're easy to find.
Mm-hmm.
All the books are online. You can find them on Amazon, all the usual places.
If you're looking for Daniel Calder online, folks, his last name is spelled K-A-L-D-E-R. Daniel Calder, author of The Infernal Library, has been our guest for the last few minutes here on It's Your Turn. Daniel, nice to meet you. Terrific to talk with you. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Dave. It was my pleasure.
Okay. So long now.
Bye.
The Two Frows Bakery in Harmony is open for call-in, pay-ahead, and curbside service. In-store customers will be limited to 2 people at a time. They thank you for your patronage and wish you and your family good health. Please call ahead to see if they're open, especially on Saturdays. Thanks for joining us for today's edition of It's Your Turn with Dave Malarkey here on WISR 680 AM. Today's broadcast is also archived for you online at WISR680.com. Tune in again next time for Dave Malarkey's It's Your Turn, weekdays from 12:30 to 1:30, right here on WISR 680.
The secret of your youth. You led me to believe you're old enough to give me love. And now it hurts to know the truth. Oh, young girl, get out of my mind. My love for you is way out of line. Better run, girl. You're much too young, girl. Beneath your perfume and makeup, you're just a baby in disguise. And though you know that it's wrong to be alone with me, that come on look is in your eyes. Whoa, young girl, get out of my mind. My love for you is way out of line. Better run. I'm sure she wonders.